Mindset Ministries takes great pleasure in presenting Dr. Agatha Thrash, one of America's foremost authors and lecturers on the subject of alternative preventative medicine. Prior to entering the field of preventative medicine, Dr. Agatha Thrash, a physician, practiced pathology for 15 years. Her husband, Calvin, also a physician, practiced internal medicine for 20 years. The Dr. Thrash co-founded Yuchi Pines Institute, a medical missionary training center in Seal, Alabama, and have authored various books including Home Remedies, Nutrition for Vegetarians, Natural Remedies, The Animal Connection, Eat for Strength, a vegetarian cookbook, as well as their latest releases, More Natural Remedies, and Food Allergies Made Simple. Dr. Agatha Thrash has appeared on radio and television interviews and has lectured throughout the United States and Canada, as well as in Norway, Puerto Rico, Bermuda, and the Orient. And now Dr. Thrash, in another presentation designed to help you live a happier, healthier, and longer life.
People often ask me about my being a vegetarian, and they often refer to the fact that I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, and that's the reason that I am vegetarian. But after I became a Seventh-day Adventist, I was not a vegetarian for quite a long time. I continued to eat meat for almost a year and to use eggs and milk for two more years after that. So it was a good little while before I became vegetarian. There is nothing in the Seventh-day Adventist religion that has any prescription against foods. It is that we feel that since one of the greatest of the talents and gifts that God has given us is that of the human body, we feel that we are obligated as a Christian duty to keep the body in good health, and therefore the very best health practices that it is possible for a person to engage in would represent that sign of appreciation for the great gift that God has given to us. And in my medical practice, I feel that anything that will make a Seventh-day Adventist sick will make a Catholic sick, or an atheist sick, or a Hindu sick. And so I simply tell everybody that the best diet they can have is the diet that I have, which I have studied carefully to see just what is the best diet, and then we try to reproduce that in our own kitchen. So I try to teach people to eat just as I do. Not that I have any vested interests in it in any way. Not in commerce in any way. And so I'm just very happy that I can, with a very free heart, tell people what I think is the best from a scientific standpoint. And just this month in Reader's Digest, there's a very nice article, about 5 pages, on beef. And the title of it is, What Price Beef? And I will just read a little bit of the summary of it at the beginning. For 30 years, farmers supplying beef, pork, and poultry to American tables have routinely mixed low doses of antibiotics into their animal feed. They do so not only because the animals stay healthier, but because, for reasons that are not entirely clear, antibiotics promote the animal's growth. The production of antibiotics for livestock feed has become a $270 million a year business that accounts for over 40% of the antibiotics sold in America. In fact, it's almost 50%. Just about half of the antibiotics sold in America go for cow feed and chicken feed. If the practice were ended, the livestock and pharmaceutical industries claim the resulting increase in disease and slower growth could cause Americans to spend $3.5 billion or more a year more for meat. Well, I have a good answer for that. Beans don't cost nearly so much. And if we stop using antibiotics for beef and chicken, beans will be lower in price, won't they? Rather than higher. But the story has another side, one that has long concerned public health officials. As some bacteria are killed by the antibiotics, others that are genetically resistant to drugs flourish. These bacteria, passed on to humans in the meat and in the milk and eggs and chicken, have the potential to cause millions of serious infections a year. So they say 3.5 billion a year more for meat. But our medical bills run into the hundreds of billions of dollars a year. I wonder how much of that is due to meat. I would say probably half. We would have a great saving if we stopped using meat. In 1977, the Food and Drug Administration made an attempt to ban tetracyclines and penicillins in animal feed, proposing that so-called animal antibiotics not designed for human use be substituted. Not surprisingly, the livestock and pharmaceutical industries protested, pointing out that there was no conclusive evidence connecting the use of low dose of antibiotics in animal feed with a specific outbreak of human illness. They lobbied successfully against the ban, and that's where matters stood. No longer. Thanks to a brilliant combination of old-fashioned detective work and the latest in molecular biology, persuasive new evidence has been found. And here's how it happened, and this is given in the May issue of Reader's Digest. Now, this came out in the medical literature probably about 6 months ago. Conclusive evidence that the antibiotics given to cattle are associated with human disease. Another thing, mass media these days are really singing my song, so I can go around singing all the time because I hear the same tune all the time. Home education doesn't hinder students. Amen. This, May 15, in USA Today, 1985. So if you would like to see this little issue, you can pick it up there. Children educated at home can fare just as well or even better, so it says right here, than children who go to school. A report funded by the National Institute of Education concludes. Very big voices these days promoting home education. Now, I have something that I would like to tell you about home education. We have been talking about keeping children at home for their schooling for a long time, for years. Last year, when we were in Topeka, Kansas, the Topeka Capital Journal on the front page came out with this article. It says, Schooling at Home Advocated. And I'll just read a few sentences of this pretty long report. It went all the way down one column and was continued over on another page. A veteran educator told the Interim Legislative Education Committee Tuesday that children should not be started in school until they are, guess how old? 8 or 10 years of age. The longtime teacher and school administrator also said that children who are taught at home should be tested to ensure that they are receiving a quality education. But he warned such tests should not begin until they are 10 to 12 years old. They are not ready for thoughtful learning until then, he told the committee. In the opinion of this veteran educator, the most pervasive form of child abuse in this country is to institutionalize a child before he or she is ready. Well, that was in Kansas.
Was that now, Dr. Moore?
Dr. Raymond Moore of Washougal, Washington. That is in Kansas. But what is going on out in Berkeley, in California, one of the largest universities, most active universities in our country, in neurophysiology? I heard one of the researchers in this field, I believe his name is Solomon, Dr. Solomon. I heard him say that a little boy is uneducable until the age of 10. That was his very word. Uneducable until the age of 10. Now that, of course, brought a great laugh from everybody. But what he meant was this, that the little boy's mind is primarily right-sided, 90% right-sided, until he is 10 years of age, when it starts changing. Little girls are not 90% right-sided. They're a little less than 90%, maybe 75% right-sided. So you can teach a little girl how to read and write and other left hemisphere type things. And I'm talking about by sidedness, I mean the side of the brain that's being used. You can teach a little girl because she is using the left side of her brain a little more than a little boy. You can teach her a little earlier. Now, because a little girl can be taught earlier, that indicates a superior brain, doesn't it? Well, let me present some more evidence. After they get to be mature, if a woman has a brain tumor in one side of her brain, let's say in the side that has to do with music, and it wipes out all the music area in the right side of the brain, she will still be able to sing and recognize tunes. But if a man has a tumor in the right side of his brain that wipes out his music area, he may be totally wiped out. He may not be able to recognize even what instrument is being played, far from being able to sing or recognize tunes. That means that her brain is superior to his, doesn't it? Well, in those ways, yes, the female brain is better. But because of the specialization of the hemispheres, the greatest musicians who ever lived are men. The greatest cooks, because they have the best imagination about foods, they are men. The greatest architects, because of the specialization of the right hemisphere that can imagine, if the right hemisphere has been trained. How do you train a little boy's right hemisphere? It is by refusing to train his left hemisphere until he is what age? 8 or 10 years of age. And if we will concentrate the left hemisphere things after the age of 10 and concentrate right hemisphere things before the age of 10, as adults, they will be able to function better. Both boys and girls will be able to function better. Before the age of 10, a child has up to 90% dominance of the right hemisphere. We can just test this in a laboratory. Just put the electrodes on and see which side of the brain is working, where the electrical activity is going on. It's easy to find that out. And it doesn't occur that the left hemisphere begins to be active until they're about 8 or 10. Earlier in girls than in boys. Now, by the age of 35, left hemisphere is 90% dominant in both. Do you then start teaching them how to be architects or musicians? You've already lost your opportunity. Your best opportunity was before the age of 10. So most of us just have to look back with regret. But what about our children? Do we have to look back with regret with them? Well, let us hope not. Let us hope that we will have learned a lesson and we will see that we have leveled out the differences between the sexes that our divine designer intended that we should have. And not that women should be pining over what they do not have. You should not allow what you cannot have or cannot acquire to prevent your enjoying and appreciating what you do have and what you can acquire. That's a basic law of life. And if women would recognize the preciousness of the specificity of their types of brains, we would hear none of this that has to do with women's lib. I can't understand women's lib. Who wants to be like a man? Only a man, I think. Certainly not a woman. A woman should want to be feminine. And there are distinct differences. And to me, it seems wise to cultivate those things which are easily cultivatable. You can make a dog to walk on 2 feet. And it is, of course, amazing to see a dog walking on 2 feet. But it's just a lot nicer to see him walking on all fours. But not so with a human. You can teach a human to walk on all fours, but it just isn't natural for him to do so. So we will recognize these differences and that these make a symmetrical and rich whole if we understand how to work in harmony with our basic nature. Now I would like to tell you about one other thing that is very important to me, and that is that each person who learns something should become a teacher. We're planning some personal health assessment classes in which we teach people how to do personal physical examinations, self-physical examinations. We're hoping to do this in the context of community health education, where we have either continuing education courses. Our pilot program in this is going to be in association with Auburn University in their continuing education department. And beginning June 25th, we will start our classes in self-physical assessment. We will teach people how to examine themselves and their children and other family members, and also what laboratory tests are available through pharmacies. About 2 years ago, there came out the pregnancy test that you can do at home. Well, there are many of these tests now, maybe 60 or 70, and to teach people what is available and how to get them and how to perform these little tests, we think can be a real service. In California, where similar programs have been structured, they have discovered that in the year following the taking of such a course, they have found that there is an average of $300 savings, half of that in doctor's office visits and half of that in lab fees and pharmaceutical agents and the like. So we think that it is well worthwhile monetarily, that people will want to come for the monetary reasons. But for us, it is to elevate the general standard of living that people have and also to assist people to understand how to take responsibility for their own health, which we think is an important thing. Now, in our present class, we're dealing with mental health and mental disease, and I would like to talk with you about some of the things that can cause serious problems with the mental health. And that of coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate represents the first thing that I would like to talk with you about: caffeinated beverages. And let me just give you a report that came out in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, Volume 93, 1984, just a few months ago. Normal persons given caffeine were shown on psychiatric tests to have elevated levels of anxiety, depression, and hostility. We spoke yesterday about the fact that physical disease in young people, such as heart attacks, are much more common if they use coffee. And here, emotional disorders. About 10 or 15 years ago, in a prominent psychiatry journal, A psychiatrist made a report that at least 10,000 people at that time were incarcerated in mental institutions for no other reason than that they used caffeinated beverages. Take these away, and the people would be perfectly well. Caffeinated beverages commonly cause problems with depression. This is the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, volume 93, page 120, for 1984. Now, in the Archives of General Psychology, volume 41 for 1984, panic disorders were related to caffeine. Panic disorders are getting much more common. I had one patient who would go down to the bank and suddenly just get in a panic. What if I had come here to rob this bank and just have panic mount until she would literally run from the bank? And she was the banker in her husband's small business, and it was quite a handicap that she could not go to the bank. But she had it every time she went to the bank. Sometimes she would have it in traffic. What if I were to be run into, or what if I were to run into a child and just get in a panic about what might happen if she were to do this or to do that? Another patient I had would get in a panic. She had three small children. She would just get in a panic about what would happen if she put her children in the washing machine. Strange kinds of little panic disorders about things that don't exist. Caffeinated beverages are often associated with this. Then here is one from the American Heart Journal. This is volume 108 for 1984. Adverse changes in heart function from drinking colas. And it's greater from drinking iced colas than it is from plain colas. But it's bad from colas, but worse if it's iced colas. But if you drink iced water, it's not so bad as it is if you drink iced colas. But it's not good even with iced colas. You can have adverse changes in heart function from drinking iced water as well. So the best thing is to drink water at tap temperature, isn't it? Or room temperature, and that is what we recommend, both for the sake of your digestion as well as for the sake of your heart. From Internal Medicine News for April 1984, a very damaging report against coffee. Listen, coffee drinkers were found to have higher blood pressures than non-coffee drinkers. Coffee drinkers also had a higher body mass index. What would that mean? More likely to be overweight. They had greater alcohol and cigarette consumption. And hear this. Lower occupational status compared with non-coffee drinkers. So if you hear someone say, there came out a report a few years ago saying that coffee drinking assisted your memory. Don't believe a word of it. When that solitary report came out, I said, something's wrong with this report because there are other influences on the brain. That was before these studies had been done. There are other influences on brain cells that certainly do not make me think that it would help memory for you to drink coffee. So when these studies came out, I was expecting them. I was just sitting there waiting for them to come out. Here is one. Caffeinated beverages and fibrocystic breast disease. Now, this comes from the Journal of the National Cancer Institute for May 1984. And it tells about how in Connecticut, a large study was done on 1,066 women showing that if they used the caffeinated beverages, they would be far more likely to have fibrocystic disease of the breast. Here is a report from the International Journal of Cancer. This is in 1981, volume 28, coffee and ovarian cancer. If a woman drinks two cups of coffee per day, she has a 2.2 greater likelihood of having cancer of the ovaries than a woman who drinks no coffee. If a woman drinks coffee, if she drinks one cup per day, she has a three times greater likelihood of having cancer of the bladder. Now that comes from the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, January 1982. And here is one from the Journal of Nutrition for April 1982. Coffee consumption during pregnancy and subsequent behavioral abnormalities in the offspring. Some studies were done in animals. Rats were used in one, mice were used in another. They found this, that if a pregnant rat was fed coffee during her pregnancy, the little mice pups, when they were born, would not be able to be taught how to walk a maze as well as could mice pups whose mothers were not given coffee during pregnancy. In another study, they found that the offspring had lighter brain weights and lighter liver weights than did those whose mothers were not fed caffeinated beverages during pregnancy. In another study, it was shown that rats fed coffee during pregnancy, the offspring had antisocial behavior. So far as rats are concerned, that would be rat crime. They would attack one another viciously. And the male rats would attack females, something that rats won't do ordinarily. I don't believe humans would either if there weren't something abnormal wrong with us. I believe that we put ourselves in a position to become abnormal. And then we have the dreadful crimes against children. It's just impossible to think of some of the atrocious crimes against children of these days. Well, it's the same thing with rats. Male rats will attack children, attack the baby rats, if their mothers were fed coffee during their pregnancies. Do you suppose one of the reasons why we're seeing such an increase in child abuse these days may be in part measured due to the fact that we take so much coffee? Practically all Americans are addicted to coffee. So let us recognize that these reports do recommend that we not use coffee, and let's just stop using it. Seventh-day Adventists have taught not to use coffee for over 100 years. And if you understand those things, you will not use coffee. They are injurious to your health and injurious to the offspring. It is a form of genocide to use these things. Now, let's go to another source of problem for the mind, and that has to do with spices. A few years ago, when the drug scene was just developing, people were using all manner of drugs and experimenting with new things. They began to experiment with spices. Some of you will recall that ginger was one of those substances used to give people highs. They gave a very strange and aberrant type of high. So some people who liked things very weird would take the ginger, and they even began to mainline ginger. And there were some deaths that came about because of that practice. It did give quite a high. It has also been recognized that in countries where there was a large use of very highly spiced foods, that there tends to be a good bit of marital disharmony. Especially sort of violent acts. Husband abuse. Or wife abuse. In which the husband would be the subject of a violent attack by his wife. Or the reverse. Now, there are other factors involved, you understand, but this is one of the things that I believe that could be involved in this. And in some primitive tribes where psychological factors might not be so operative as in a complex society such as ours, it has been found that there are some societies that are just naturally violent. And that most of these are associated with the heavy use of animal products and the heavy use of spices, especially black pepper. And there are some peoples, some native peoples, who are pretty much protected and virginal, who in just their ordinary interactions with each other have a sort of violent way of expressing themselves. So that two men may come up to each other and just start talking as if they were just scolding one another like this, instead of just coming up and mildly bowing as some of the Orientals might and having a very gentle type of interaction with one another. And parents, when they correct their children, correct them in a very scolding and violent way, often associated with the high use of spices, especially in early life. Here is one that shows that the use of spices increases your risk for cancer. This is from Anti-Cancer Research, Volume 4, the year is 1984, and the page is 117. This presents the tumorigenicity and mutagenicity of capsaicin. Now, capsaicin is a chemical substance produced naturally in hot peppers, black peppers. Capsaicin, C-A-P-S-A-I-C-I-N. Tumorigenicity, what does that mean? Means it causes tumors, that's cancers. What about mutagenicity, what does that mean? That means it causes mutations. So during pregnancy, there could be abnormalities in the offspring associated with the use of peppers. And there are some researchers who say that in countries where the use of spices is high, there is also a higher incidence of mutations, of abnormalities in offspring due to mutations in cells. Here is another one. On this one comes from the Journal of Food and Chemical Toxicology. This is volume 22, page 109, 1984. This is on cinnamon, showing its mutagenicity. Now, if you use spices, you are much, much more likely to desire to use alcoholic beverages and coffee and tobacco and drugs, as we have already presented. A diet high in fats and sugars and protein and with plenty of between meal snacks promotes early maturation of children. And here is an article in the September 4 issue of Science News linking homosexuality with precocious puberty. Now what that means is this, that if a young man has a precocious puberty, an early puberty, that he is more likely to be homosexual. And the reason for that is postulated that at the time that the sexuality develops, if the person is still in segregated groups, he is more likely to turn toward another little boy rather than toward a little girl if he is in a non-segregated group, such as happens if sexuality develops at perhaps the age of 13 or 14 instead of 8 or 9 when little boys are no longer segregated into purely masculine or purely feminine, and little girls in purely feminine groups. I have a number of questions that I need to ask from this. Is it on this particular?
Yes.
Okay, we'll take.
What would be the difference between a spice and, let's say,
an herb? All right. The difference between a spice and an herb. A spice is a fruiting part of a tropical zone plant. An herb is the leafy part of a temperate zone plant. That's just generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Would include in spices, ginger, nutmeg, clove, cinnamon, pepper. And in herbs would include basil, tarragon, thyme, mint, and sage, but would also loosely include garlic and onion and a few other things like that.
What about the bark?
Bark, like cinnamon, would be also a spice. That's just a sort of loose definition. Now some questions. How much vitamin A do we need? Let me encourage you not to weigh nor measure your food, but rather to use a natural diet, not confine yourself to one class of foods, but to recognize that for thousands of years before we knew there were such things as vitamins and minerals, people lived very successfully on a very natural diet. And we're given the counsel that it is not wise for us to measure and weigh our foods, that it would be better for us just to eat our food with thanksgiving, eat a wide variety, not confine ourselves to any single groups of foods, and that this would be quite adequate. And I would like to urge that for you too. But for those of you who, for sake of teaching or to substantiate what you say from a scientific standpoint, you can find in standard textbooks of nutrition the minimum daily requirements, which, by the way, are set by a committee and not by the body's absolute needs, but you can also find such a chart in our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians. If you will eat plenty of yellow fruits and yellow vegetables and dark green vegetables, you will have an adequate supply of vitamin A without making a special attempt to do so. Here's a question on X-rays and microwaves and the effects on the body. X-rays are what are called cumulative in the body. When we are exposed to X-rays, there is a cumulative effect on the body. You never lose that. Time does not erase that cumulative effect. But the next time you get an X-ray, it raises your level a little bit more. Year by year, the radiation that you get from cosmic radiation, which comes to us from outer space, also raises our radiation level a little bit. So we're constantly inching upward in our radiation exposure. We never go down at all. Some years ago, I recognized that I had had a world of exposure to X-rays, and I decided that I hoped I wouldn't have to have any more at all. When I was in medical school, as a part of my training, we were rather encouraged to learn how to do X-raying techniques. So we would just go down to the X-ray department and take pictures of one another, just like snapping a camera. When I began to realize how much exposure I had had, I decided enough was enough. And if I could avoid any more, I would certainly do so. So I even chose my dentist with great care, one who would be willing to treat me without using X-rays. And I have had very few X-rays since then. Very few. Maybe two or three. Once when I was in an automobile accident and broke my back, we took two. Ordinarily, they would have taken many more, but I said, let's take as few as we can to make the diagnosis. So we took one this way and one on the side, and that was all, no more. With dental X-rays, I've not had one in the last 25 years. And I believe that any one of you could also choose a dentist who would work with you in that way. Well, I've been several times to a chiropractor, made the same statement to him. If you can do what you need to do without using X-rays, that's fine. But if you have to use X-rays, I think I'll just pass. So he said, well, I can handle everything without an X-ray. So he just used his fingers instead of an X-ray to make the diagnosis and to locate where my problem was, which I knew that he could do because any one of these masseuses that we have around here could locate my problem without any difficulty at all, and so I felt that a chiropractor surely should be able to also, and sure enough, he could, and I was able to work on my back without any problem at all. Now, let's go to microwaves. What about microwaves? Well, we don't know much about microwaves. They've only been in use about 12 years, 15 years. X-rays had to be in use about 25 years before we started recognizing the difficulties that we had with them. So I think that it might be the same thing with microwaves. I don't feel really comfortable about microwaves. If you use a microwave oven, take it down every 6 months to the health department and let them test your microwave and make certain that it isn't leaking. They have the equipment to do so because they have to go into cafes and restaurants and test their equipment. So most large departments of health have this kind of equipment, and you can get your microwave checked. And it would be good if you would do so. Just do that every 6 months. And I think that we can, in this way, recognize leakage. But is there any problem when your microwave is not leaking? That is, quote, leaking. Well, we don't know. We do know that a person can just drive by in a car, and if he has one of these radar detectors, it will upset the radar detector if a microwave is in operation, ordinary operation, inside a home nearby. Well, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. I'm concerned. So what I say is this: put as much distance between you and your microwave oven as you can. And if you don't have one, investigate it thoroughly and do a little soul searching before you decide to invest in one. Oh, the question is also about, does it hurt the food? Well, again, I don't know. Until up till about 10 years ago, the government was saying that x-raying food did not leave any residue from x-raying in food. But about 10 years ago, they started seeing that there was a change made in food from x-raying it. But, of course, we're still x-raying food. Well, what about microwaves? Well, the government is saying that there is no change in food brought about by the microwaving that would leave any kind of deleterious effect. But, again, I just have to say we have not had enough experience with it to know. And I don't feel that I can endorse a microwave until we have had that much experience, maybe 50 years of experience with it. So if anybody uses a microwave, it would be proceed at your own risk. If meat, caffeine, and sugar are taken occasionally on a vegetarian diet, how can it affect the body and mental reaction? If you take anything that will harm the body, you will get harm from it. Now, there are some poisons that are poisonous in any quantity whatsoever. There are some poisons that are poisonous only in large quantities. Oxygen is one of those. Oxygen is a poison. But it's poisonous only if you get a large quantity of it. Then it will start making the eyes grow, and a skin grow on the lenses of the eyes, and some changes occur in the lungs that will make it so that you don't breathe so well. Do you see my point on that? That most anything, vitamin A is a deadly poison, and yet it is required, just like oxygen. A required substance, but a poison under certain circumstances. So you see, all of these things are operative at the same time that we are dealing with this thing of caffeine and meat and this kind of thing. Is it possible to retain water in your tissues and still be dehydrated? And the answer is yes. The dehydration of the blood that comes on with by dehydrating your tissues, but your tissues can still be overly hydrated. But the first thing that is dehydrated is the tissue. But if you have over hydration of the tissue, the blood can be dehydrated by the action of the kidneys or by osmotic problems that occur. And you still have dehydrated blood, but you may have fluid in your cavities and fluid in your feet and fluid in your hands from having too much fluid in the tissues. What causes brown spots or liver spots on the hand and face and other parts of the body? Two things. Number one is the use of free fats. And number two, aging of the skin. One you can control and the other you can't control. So if you don't like those brown spots on your hands and face, one thing that you can do is to eliminate free fats. And that will help with that. Also, the little keratoses that people get on the nose and ears will be greatly helped if you stop using free fats, because they are made much worse by the use of free fats. Loss of pigment in the skin is called vitiligo. And vitiligo, we have not had enough experience with that to give you specifics, but if anyone specially wants something on vitiligo, I believe we may have something in a new book that is going to be published, we hope, later this year or next year, a chapter in that. And we'd be happy to photocopy what we have and give it to anyone who would be interested in that. One more question. What about a diet for a person who has had the thyroid removed? If you have had a total thyroidectomy and no thyroid is left, as one would have for a cancer of the thyroid, you must have thyroid replacement. If you do not, you cannot live. We cannot live without thyroid. So you must have. If you have had a subtotal thyroidectomy, then you have probably enough thyroid left that we could stimulate by ordinary means. We have not learned how, by natural means, to replace the thyroid hormone. There may be natural replacements, but we have not discovered them.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.